From KCRW in Santa Monica, this is The Treatment.
Welcome to The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. You can also hear the show at KCRW.com. How can you not like a man whose watchwords seem to be sex, drugs, and Alan Bennett? Would be my guest, writer, performer, actor, and self-biographer, Russell Brand. His book is my book he worked. Russell, thanks so much for doing this.
Well, it's a joy to be here. Thank you.
There is a phrase you use early in the book that I think is so loaded and so descriptive of you. It's a phrase, pathologically mischievous, when you stomp the old gentleman's flowers.
Yes, that was naughty of me and regrettable. That has had an impact on people. Yeah, when I was 7 years old, I was instructed not to by an elderly neighbour who had taken an interest in me, a kind of paternal interest, because my own dad weren't around. He said, oh, look at these flowers, and he explained to me the cycle of life. I think I may be embellishing this story slightly, but as I recall, he showed me these nasturtiums and told me how they embody beauty and how they were perennial and how they would always return, that some things in life are forever, not everything's transient and passing. Then as he went off to use the lavatory, he said, don't stamp on those flowers, Russell. And prior to that announcement, stamping on the flowers had never crossed my mind. But after it had been articulated, it seemed inevitable that I had to stamp on the flowers, that I had to fulfil my destiny. My dark destiny was to tread them flowers back into the dirt from whence they came, to pound them into yesterday under my sandaled foot. And I did just that, and then I felt naughty.
There really is that awareness, even at that age, of how there is an astonishing lack of impermanence. And that comes before your mother gets ill. At that early age, you seem to kind of stamp that kind of awareness into yourself.
I've always recognised intuitively that a great many of the things that we're told are unnecessary and duplicitous, that we're instructed to behave in a certain manner, not for the reasons outlined, but merely for restriction itself, merely because people need us to conform and to be atomised and to behave as passive consumers rather than active citizens and participants in the moment.
You talk about that in the book. You say rebel children, rebel against school and the kind of conforming they're trying to shoehorn you into.
Yes. This is something I believe in. Not needlessly and recklessly and upsetting things. You shouldn't, upset the staff at your school. I'm just saying, recognise that a lot of the information they're giving you is unnecessary and they're actually making you docile.
I love the section in the book when you talked about leaving drama behind at drama school and encountering comedy. Comedy seems to be one of the things that really, in a lot of ways, both satisfies you and keeps you coming back for more.
You're right. Because of its destructive yet creative potency, I love comedy. Admire particularly the ability, perhaps best embodied by Richard Pryor, to turn the tragic, the personally tragic, into the comedic.
I was really moved because you mentioned, besides Richard Pryor, perhaps my favourite comedian in the last 15 years, the late Bill Hicks.
Yeah, I love him.
He cut such a swath through the UK that he did not hear in the States. Mm. Why do you think that was, that he was so successful there?
Well, personally, what I found appealing about the work of Bill Hicks was his ability to articulate information and educate you in a way that wasn't condescending. Because he was a sincere man, wasn't he? And normally I don't like sincerity from a comedian, but he was able to be earnest in a way.
But he was not sentimental.
He certainly was, no. There was no trace of mawkishness, but an incredible passion. The fact that there is hope that we can change, that every moment is an opportunity for change and improvement. And Bill Hicks weren't satisfied. Bill Hicks thought that we could change, thought that the Gulf War was ridiculous, wasn't afraid to say so, and was able to say so in a way that was brilliantly amusing. He were better and funnier and quicker than his competitors. And show, sometimes they act like, oh, we're the grown-up, shut up, you idiots, we know what we're doing. If you knew what we know, then you'd do as we say. So we've made that decision for you by not giving you the information or the options. Bill Hicks proves that there are opportunities for the left, that there is an alternative.
One of the things that you always allude to in the book is you want to make people ask questions, though. And that can sometimes be an offensive thing, to rouse people from this state of being kind of filled with nothing that you talk about.
Yes, there's no sense going through life all stupefied, not participating, no sense fearing the grave when you're already living in a coffin. Seems like a preposterous way to go on. I like people to be constantly inquiring. I don't know, it's just like a natural instinct to fulfil. What's that Aristotelian principle? I think it might be called eudaimonia, that a flower only wants to bloom, that you want to fulfil your potential, that you want to grow, the need to grow and to shine and to be in alignment with the energy of the universe that's you know, I don't want to get all new age about it, but that it's happening anyway, just to be in alignment with what is already happening, not to be curtailed by logic and duplicity.
I guess it's Russell Brand, his book is My Bookie Walk. The thing that I think people don't really get until they see you, if they really read the book, is just what a kind of sunny disposition guide you are, because there is such a voluminous number of ideas and opinions. Your autobiography is almost like a series of journal entries to me, and that's what's so much fun about reading it. I mean, you really get a sense of where you are at each given chapter. Was that the intent?
Yeah, it was, because I thought, like, and if it's just a list of, oh, yeah, I've done this, I hosted this award ceremony, I had sex with this person, I looked out of that window, it might become a tedious itinerary. But some, you know, I suppose that the job of the comedian is to make amusing observations. And, you know, I'm glad it fulfilled that function.
But I think you also gave it a context, because there are lots of books by comedians that are nothing but just lists and these kind of comic observations. But there's always a kind of, and I think, a real narrative context often. You talk about how you picked that up in school when you were studying theater, how you learned about narrative tradition and how important that was.
Yes, I did. I mean, like at the drama school where I was trained, they, you know, it's very fortunate to me that they took it dead seriously. Perhaps because really it is such a frivolous profession to be an actor, just showing off for a job. But I suppose we forget that its origins are in religion and ritual and theatre and the birth of tragedy. That really performance is about the acknowledgement and yet the defiance of death, registering the things that are constant. I remember the principal of that school, Christopher Fettes. Anthony Hopkins learned from Christopher Fettes, and he based the character of Hannibal Lecter on him. And that and Christopher Fettes once in the class that I was in said that, he goes, when you go to the theatre, you're educating your audience. You're telling them that ultimately, regardless of what the play is about, the central message is you're going to die, you're going to die, you're going to die, and that's £10 for the privilege. They're just hollering. You're just reminding people of their mortality, you know. And in so doing, the beauty of the moment and how sacrosanct it is. Sometimes I think, when I meet a beautiful woman, I think, what on earth are you doing not sleeping with me? What's the alternative? What is on your television that you're not going to live this moment to the full? What is it? Because I've got 100 channels and there's nothing on any of them. Let's go.
Now, what does it take for you to get worked up, really? I mean, when were you really first aware as a performer that you kind of brought the tradition of theater and the kind of the anarchy of stand-up comedy to what you were doing? When was that moment for you?
I think a sense of social animosity was born of personal alienation, like often happens. Like, as I grew up feeling like I didn't really fit in anywhere and didn't really belong.
You talk about that, not fitting in your grandmother's house and not fitting in your father's house, basically going from a series of houses that you didn't fit in.
Yeah. And it weren't that I was an odd shape or peculiarly large. I mean, no, I didn't fit in the social context. It weren't like each house was just perched on the top of my head like a little bonnet. I was a tiny little child. You could have fitted me in an egg cup if you'd had the willpower, but I just felt like I didn't fit into them social structures. And either, isn't it that thing that George Bernard Shaw says, the reasonable man looks at the world and asks how he can fit in with it. The unreasonable man looks at the world and asks how it can fit in with him. Therefore, the world is always changed by unreasonable men. And I am unreasonable because I think a lot of things is daft and unnecessary. There are a great many beautiful things about civilization, but there is always the constant possibility of change. And I suppose because I grew up in a situation where I didn't feel happy or comfortable, it's planted in me that the yearning for change.
I guess as you talk about this, I wonder if you think yourself as being Byronic, and that sense of being a real romantic who wants the world to be a romantic place.
Yeah, I do think that. And it also, Byron, he was perhaps, you know, he was a good celebrity, wasn't he, of his time, when fame weren't a dirty word, when fame was a beautiful thing to be, when it was good to be famous.
But also those questions that weren't being asked of actors at the beginning of the 20th century and the 19th century. Actors are basically thought of as being thieves and, you know, hung out with prostitutes. I mean, they were the lowest rung of society.
I'm trying to keep that tradition alive.
But here's one of the things you don't really get at the book, and you're talking about this a little bit, but you're a big guy, and what you bring into the room just by sheer size and energy is something that people are probably going to react to. And I imagine when you're doing your thing, people, normal-sized human beings, if you will, are going to be – you will see that kind of spark of fear every once in a while.
Yes. size is something I've been gifted with, both in terms of my persona and my great big lumbering frame. I mean, I'm not Robert Wadlow. I'm not absurdly big. I'm not likely to turn up in the Guinness World of Records with one of my shoes with a dog sleeping in it. So look at that. I could use your shoes as a dog basket. I'm just quite tall. Sometimes I think people go, oh, you're taller than I expected. And I thought, did you think that my personality was making up for something?
It's The Treatment. My guest is the author of my bookie book, perhaps my favorite title of all time. He's the actor, comedian, and writer Russell Brand. You're constantly assessing every situation that you're in, and you don't get at that in the book so much. But I wonder when you were aware that your mind was constantly like taking everything in as a way to sort of feed you in some way. When you came to that state of awareness, was it during drama school or after when you started to write?
Yes, I don't know when this constant analysis... I'll tell you why, because people are always saying you think too much. You know, when people tell you that, oh, you think too much, you're thinking too much. Don't think so much, you know, like people say it to you. That's when I became aware of what I don't think I am thinking too much. I think I'm just clever. How come this, when did this become a handicap?
Never. That's why you're here. But I think that that's an incredible thing to do, because there's a kind of self-awareness that begs to be offered up to a bigger audience. And there must have been that point for you that was the fork in the road. You had to decide between real drama. And we should say the performance you give in Bedtime Stories with Adam Sandler is a pretty conventional, in some ways, piece of acting as compared to in Forgetting Sarah Marshall, where obviously you're taking off in a lot of ways. Yes. And I wondered if it was like a tough point for you to decide which were those things you were going to do, because you don't really explain it so much in the book.
You know, I'm quite an ambitious person, Elvis, so I can't spend my whole life, you know, sort of doing quirky turns. You know, there's going to be a point where I have to do things that are conventional so I can reach the audience that I would like. So necessarily I have to fit into the paradigm to a point. But hopefully I can do this without compromising too much. And it was, you know, it's like good to be out of work with Adam Sandler. He's brilliant, one of the biggest movie stars in the world. So it's an opportunity for me to learn. But obviously, ultimately, what I want to be able to do is define the parameters within which I work. But I think to get those kind of opportunities, generally speaking, there is an element of compromise.
Did you feel that when you... Cause I feel like a big part of you really responded to the stuff in theater. You talk about that stuff in the training, that you felt like you were given a tradition to kind of shackle a lot of your impulses to and a lot of the intellectual questions that you had. Theater gave you that. And I wonder if you felt like you missed something in walking away from that to some extent.
I don't know if I have entirely worked away from it. To be absolutely honest, my intentions on going, like, they gave me that, that almost, I received that education inadvertently. I went there as part of my journey to escape from my past and to become successful. And when I was there, it turned out they indoctrinate you quite brilliantly with the traditions of theatre, be it Greek or Spanish or Germanic, and like, they educate you there and sort of teach you about Shakespeare and prose and what it means to be an actor and what the aims of drama and art in general ought be and could be. But I don't feel like I've walked away from a tradition by appearing in a Disney movie or a Universal movie. Or we all really exist under the umbrella of media. We're all part of it, aren't we? Whatever we do, to whatever extreme of these limited parameters we operate within, we're still part of the whole, you know? It's sort of necessary. You know, for example, I can obviously sense that this the direction that this radio station tends towards and the direction it leans towards, but if it was, you know, genuinely a problem, it would be shut in half an hour, wouldn't it? If it just became genuinely subversive, if any of us did. So I can, you know, I can be a little bit subversive, but not, so I don't want to get shot yet.
I don't want you to get shot either. We still got another 15 minutes to go.
All right, well, hold your fire.
We'll take a break. It's The Treatment. My guest is Russell Brand. His new book, his first book, finally published in the States, is My Bookie Wook. It's a comforting name for a book that's not quite so comforting, but fascinating anyway. It's The Treatment. More to come.
You're listening to The Treatment with Elvis Mitchell from the studios of KCRW Santa Monica.
Welcome back. It's The Treatment, which you can also hear at kcrw.com. My guest is, you certainly know him from Forgetting Sarah Marshall and his great special on Comedy Central, in which he used the words, I'd like to say, tautology and Foucault in the same monologue. He's Russell Brand. His new book, his first book, is My Bookie Wook. You mentioned Alan Bennett, who is, even though he's kind of demure, he's still kind of an outsized intellect. And clearly that's something you responded to.
Yes, I suppose so. I love Alan Bennett dearly, because, you know, a lot of his writing is incredibly sort of meticulous, and you said the word demure, but there are tracts of his prose that are, you know, Byronic. He's like the way he describes nature and his awareness of death and his awareness of his own muted, apparently muted, sexuality. So, like, yeah, I adore him as a writer. I think he's a sort of hugely paradoxical figure. But most of all, I suppose, he's hilariously funny and beautiful and delicate and gentle. There's, like, he talks about in I listen to these diaries of his. There's these lovely BBC diaries of Alan Bennett's, right? And it's good because usually if you were to purchase an audio book, it would say, you have purchased this audio book. This is chapter one, read by Alan Bennett, right? But it just goes, like, so you put it on and it goes, Thursday, 12 o'clock, mother walks in, straight away you're sort of smashed in the face by Alan Bennett. It's quotidian rituals. And in one, he describes his parents belonged to, there was a cooperative supermarket system in the UK, sort of, it was ages ago, where you'd give a number, you'd receive discounts and stuff. And he recites this number, 21345. This number, along with my old military rank number, I would respond to unthinkingly by raising a hand, even if it were to select me for death. And it's such a beautiful blend of something routine and mundane and ordinary and the idea of that you could ever be selected for death.
Have you had a chance to meet him?
No, I haven't. I'd love to. Morrissey, another great hero of mine, met him, and he says that he's a wonderful person. Morrissey...
Tell about your friend, Mark Morrissey, you mentioned it.
Yeah, I've become friends with Morrissey, which is sort of ludicrous. It's like becoming, you know, friends with Thor or something, that he's actually real. I can't obviously reconcile entirely the Morrissey of my childhood with the man I know, because it would be impossible, you know, sort of what someone can, through their work, inspire and what they can create, and then he's still got to be a normal bloke. But Morrissey does a pretty good job of being a day-to-day hero, at least in my eyes. The time I've spent with him, he's sort of incredibly verbose, self-aware, loquacious and witty. Here's some funny things he said. Like, I was trying to make a documentary with him, film him and stuff, and I was going, oh, it's difficult, Morrissey, because he was living in hotels at that time. It's difficult, Morrissey, ever to get a schedule together with you, you know, with you not having anywhere to live. And he went, or nothing to live for. Brilliantly, without missing a beat.
Who was, for you in music terms, like a big influence? You're so musical as a performer.
In terms of influence, really, like sort of Bowie and Mark Bolan and a lot of sort of glam rockers sort of had an impact on me, but all similarly punk, you know, sort of I love the Pistols and Into the Clash a bit, but none of these people had the kind of influence on me that, say, Peter Cook did, or, you know, Alan Bennett, you've already mentioned.
You talk about Peter Cook in the book. And
yeah, I love him, you know, because he was elegant and sort of... Again, because for the class he came from, he had a kind of his entitlement. He had a huge sense of entitlement. They often said of Peter Cook that had he not become, you know, sort of the greatest satirist of all time, that he would have been in the Foreign Office, that he would have been a diplomat or a politician. And he carried himself with that sense that people born of class tend to have of, well, this is here I am. This is what I'll be doing. He weren't up for grabs with Peter Cook, but he had the imagination of a lunatic.
One of the things that's kind of fun about reading the book is the footnotes for us Americans who have to have some things explained to us.
Yes. Actually, Elvis, what impacted me when doing them is that I thought I've got incredibly low cultural references just on the page that I've opened, like, you know, the sort of the glossary that I've necessarily had to provide shows what kind of nomenclature and cultural references I have. And this one that we've opened on, the Beano, The Beano is a beloved children's comic which is about 60 years old and centres on naughty, destructive children. It has a good rebellious spirit which has been eroded by the passage of time. I read it recently and everyone seemed a bit square. That might be because I'm now an adult, not a silly boy. But it shows that the Beano is, you know, that's at least one of the things. And the other things are all West Ham United footballers and, you know, EastEnders, soap opera stars. Wurzel Gummidge, a children's television scarecrow, comes to life.
But it's the glossary of basically all these things you love. The add-on things, the footnote things, have like an extra kind of dollop of spirit and enthusiasm in them to keep the velocity of the book going.
Absolutely. You can't drop the velocity in a book. People will get bored. They'll throw it out the window. People could get hurt. The corners are very hard, Elvis. But I didn't choose what to footnote. An American and one of your own people.
One of my own people? A black person?
No, an American. I don't know if it was a black person. I didn't specify. If they said, would you prefer a black person to read this book? I said, I don't care. It makes no difference to me what colour the person who reads this book is. As long as it's an American, it must be an American. Right? They said, these are the things I don't understand.
It's The Treatment. My guest, Russell Brand, we're talking about his amazing book, My Bookie Wook. Now, I guess I find myself wondering, when you were doing a movie, when you were doing Forgetting Sarah Marshall, how much of yourself were you allowed to bring to it? Because obviously it was shaped for you, but how much room did you get?
Loads. The storyline, Jason wrote the story in the
Jason Segel story.
Brilliant writer, well, funny fella. But they said with the character, one of the things that's good about Judd Apatow movies is they let you improvise. They just go, right, be spontaneous. And then Nick Stoller, who directed that film, just asked me, oh, what was it, you know, like, wanted to know experiences, what it was like for me being a drug addict in recovery and as a famous person in England and how that would, you know, affected me and the sort of impact that's had on me. You know, they plunder you, Judd Apatow Productions, for like your past. They want as much as they can, which is good, yeah, because I think it gives very distinctive voices to the characters in their films, and that's why I think the dialogue in his movies is so, you know, especially, I don't know, beautiful, unique, because they've drawn from the you know, they have everyone's involvement. They're not precious about it. Obviously, the, you know, the people that are creatively leading the project take charge. But like in terms of me, I mean, yeah, I am, like, if you look at the comparison between me and the character I played, I am a recovering drug addict. I am a performer. I'm obsessed with women and aesthetics and beauty of all kinds. I've got a kind of a dilettante's interest in the new age. I've kind of like, I've got an ill-researched, autodidactic knowledge of most things and an education in nothing. You know, so like really, there's the comparisons are sort of you know, astute.
When you sit down to write,
yeah,
what's that like for you?
And
do you really?
It's hard, isn't it, writing? You have to concentrate. No one's laughing. No one's touching you. No one's going to fellate you as a result of what you've written.
Then you're doing it wrong.
No, well, they will eventually, but not at the time. Not while I'm doing it, which would be a lovely distraction. And we could get an extra paragraph out of me, you know. But you have to commit to it and you have to delay gratification. And that's not something that I'm good at, Elvis. You know, so, like, I love
But do you not take any gratification from the writing itself?
Yeah, when I'm into it, like, once I've kicked off, right, this is one of my favourite bits of writing from it. It's chapter 10. This bit I really like. I talk about like the first time that I ever went on stage, right? It was a school play when I was 15 years old. This is one of my favourite bits. And when I wrote it, I got a little bit emotional. And I thought, well, this must be right because I'm feeling it. So it is. This is me doing a school play, 15 years old, Bugsy Malone at the comprehensive school, which just means a normal state school where I was educated, such as it was. There was 5 minutes more backstage, standing there with the tension, stifling the urge to vomit, already drained, nothing left to give but a performance. And then I walked out onto the stage for the first time in my life. The light. The light is so bright that all that remains is you in the darkness. You can feel the audience breathing. It's like holding a gun or standing on a precipice and knowing you must jump. It feels slow and fast. It's like dying and being born. It's like falling in love and being utterly alone with God. You taste your own mouth and you feel your own skin. And I knew I was alive and I knew who I was and that wasn't who I'd been up till then. I'd never been so far away, but I knew I was home. I know everything, I thought. I knew I'd never leave and I never have. When I wrote that, I thought, yeah, that was what it felt like. So that's what you want to do, isn't it, when you're creating? You want to think, I've communicated successfully what I felt. And that was what I felt. And when I wrote it, I was probably, you know, 30. And like when I felt it, I was 15. So, and why that's important to me is because that was it. That was my salvation. Like that was my way out. And like, I've not let go of that. I've never let go of that. In that first moment, I was on the stage, oh, thank God, there's a way out. There is an escape. And that's it. I boarded a train that I'm still on.
as we talk about this, though, I mean, there's that sense, these things, again, that just sort of clash up against each other. And some part of you has to lie that these parts of you that are constantly warring against each other. You know, this sense of having to sort of keep your head together enough to observe things, but also wanting to throw yourself into the fray and moving from one appetite to another. I mean, I just have to think, not even in retrospect, but just being able to chronicle that stuff and to get it out, because so much of you has been about consuming and putting things out. And this book gave you a chance to get all that stuff out.
What you say sort of about dichotomy within me, that's certainly accurate. Because I sometimes think, like, when I read that book, I think, how can anyone who have felt such compunction and contrition for the transgressions that have been committed, how can anyone who could feel that kind of contrition have ever have done it? Why would you do these things if you'd feel so bad about it? That's what's astonished me, is that my capacity to do things that I regret and do bad things. You'd think that surely the process of the grief that I undergo having made these transgressions would be a preventative, would somehow, you know, stop me bloody doing it. But I'm always like, so I feel so awful if I do anything bad, when I'm vain, when I'm sort of impolite, or if I think I've upset someone. It makes me feel terrible. And it's never my objective to offend people. But
really? Wait a second. Really? It's never your objective to offend people?
No, I don't want to offend people. That's not... When I think of what do I want to do, and I think, oh, I want to make people feel happy. I want people to belong. I want people to laugh, and I want people to feel loved. I want to encourage the things about us that are beautiful. I want to do the diametric opposite of every magazine that's ever made you feel inadequate, insecure, over. Weight, or that you're not good enough. I want to do the opposite to that. I think that everyone's enough. I think we all have everything we need in the moment. I don't want to make people feel insecure.
It's a treatment. My guest is Russell Brand. His book is my bookie book. Most of the regrets I remember in the book are things that you didn't do. You talk about things you wish you had done, that you hadn't, when you didn't follow your impulses all the way through. There's a kind of frustration that comes out of that for you.
Yeah. There is, actually. I sort of think, you know, that sort of that rage against the dying of the light, Dylan Thomas thing. Because I sort of think that was all, like, at school, they couldn't really get you in that much trouble. They can't do that much. You don't kill anybody. Sort of rebel more. Like, you know, question everything. Like, I wish I'd got in more trouble at school, and I got in a lot of trouble. I got thrown out of a fair few. But I just think that, really, they make it... I went back to my old school sort of recently, just because I was on a sentimental journey with a friend of mine, and we wandered onto the premises of the school, and, like, they had to go, Russell, get out of the way, because the kids are going to have break in a minute, and it will be pandemonium, because, as I have made abundantly clear, I'm dead famous in England, so if they see me in the playground, it will kick off. Right, so they had to get me into a back room there where all the staff were, but the secretaries there at my old school all wanted proximity in their photos done with me. Some of them was alluring, Elvis. Some of them I would have had me way with if left alone for a buccaneering moment, but they kept me, shepherded me from room to room, anonymous corridor to anonymous corridor, like they'd always done when I was a kid. And there, in some corner, I happened upon a child being chastised. Not chastised in the moment. She was sat there in her little single desk penitentiary, having been punished for some minor misdemeanour, some irrelevance. Sat there she was, doing lines all redundantly, writing something out that she'd never need to know, more times than she'd ever need them. And she looked so troubled, and she had the weight of the world on her little shoulders. She'd been a bad girl. She's told she was a bad girl. You could see it in her eyes and her little downturned face. And I just want to say, it's going to be all right. None of this stuff is serious, you know. These people got no power over you. There's nothing wrong with you. It's all a lie. Don't be conned by it. You're going to be all right. The thing inside you that was making you rebel or be naughty, and that is making you now be unhappy, that's what's beautiful about you. And I, you know, wish I'd had the time, but the PE master was there, and he was always quite tough, and he was still tough then, and he strong-armed me out of the way before I could plant the seeds of revolution in another fertile mind.
Well, I think you've done it here, and I thank you so much for your time.
Cheers, Elvis. Thank you.
My guest is Russell Brand. His great book, You Can't Put It Down, is my bookie book. Our recording engineer here at Carnegie Studios in New York is Lashik Borchek. Bob Carlson is the editor. Gemma Dempsey is the producer. I'm exhausted. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment.
An audio archive of this and other programs can be found at kcrw.com. For questions and comments about The Treatment, please email us at thetreatment@kcrw.com. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.